Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we're asking Gordon Marino how to live authentically in an inauthentic age. There are two main stereotypes about what philosophers are supposed to look like. The first is that of an ancient octogenarian in a toga, standing before a crowd shouting about what is real. The second is a younger, berated and turtlenecked coffeehouse malcontent who complains that life is suffering. The old man in the toga is an optimist, a person who has faith in the power of reason and culture. He inspires us to democracy and science and urges us to pursue virtue, at least a virtue suitable to our proper station in life. The chain-smoking complainer, on the other hand, is a pessimist who believes that everyone around him is a phony. He implores us to embrace our ennui, but he rejects the idea that anyone is destined to be one thing or another. The two do have things in common. They're both men, of course, and European. But more philosophically, they're both interested in self-knowledge. They think that people deeply misunderstand what they think they know and are reluctant to change their minds or ways. They also each assert that it is individuals' responsibility to look in the mirror and to see him or herself for who they really are. Their most radical difference lies in their understanding of what it means for people to be free. The toga-wearing Greek thinks that people are only free when they master self-knowledge, emotion, bias, opinion. These things lead us astray, he argues, while ignorance keeps us in slavery. The beret-clad Frenchman, or Algerian, or German, or Dane, thinks that we're always free, and that it is our endless array of choices that lead us to hide our true selves. We play roles, he claims, instead of committing to our actual desires, and we shirk responsibility leading to the greatest sins of all, inauthenticity and bad faith. Jean-Paul Sartre, the inspiration for the café-based stereotype, was an existentialist. He argued that human existence precedes our essence. This means that unlike Socrates, the man in the toga, he did not believe in a divine plan or blueprint that guides human life. We are not made in God's image, Sartre thought. The beginning did not start with the word. There is only the brute fact of our physical existence, so we must choose rather than discover the meaning of our lives. To put it another way, for Socrates, we are characters and moral commitments. For Sartre and the other existentialists, we are simply what we do. Like all stereotypes, my sketches here are oversimplifications. Plato's Socrates was not always consistent, and the classical Greeks disagreed about many things. As for the existentialists, if they were indeed a single school of thought, they were a diverse one. Some believed in God, some didn't, some were overtly political, others purely academic. Nevertheless, existentialism replaced the faith in life's universal meaning with a lamentation about our universal experience. The ever-present awareness we would someday die, that our perspective was inescapable, and that we, and only we, were accountable for our actions. They made room for Freud in the subconscious, for feminism and cultural oppression, and for alienating notions of otherness. Their advice was not romantic like the classical Greeks, it was harsh and dramatic, but profoundly relevant to today's world. And that's what our guest will argue on today's episode, that philosophy is a form of self-help. Together we will ask whether existentialism can mitigate depression, anxiety, whether it can provide an antidote to perpetual social network posturing, and whether it can help craft meaning for our lives that feel too fast, too busy, and too superficial. The fact of the matter is that we as a culture feel lost. The United States is among the highest standard of living in history, yet Americans are becoming more and more unhappy. We're an angry people, suspicious, jealous, escapist, and heavily medicated. And the most privileged of us are the least content. The upper middle class has almost everything they'll ever need, and yet they experience their lives as under siege. This experience would not be unfamiliar to Sartre, Kierkegaard, or the other existentialists. We turn to them because they were here already. They were born in times of crises, war, and estrangement that mirror our own. They witnessed a divided culture of entitlement and despair, analyzed the political and spiritual consequences of fakery, and laid it bare for our examination. They diagnosed the modern pathology and pointed out that quietly acquiescing to our own alienation is just another form of collaboration. They postulated remedies, too, but we've either marginalized or forgotten them. It's time to take another look. It's time to crack open the novels, plays, and treatises and revisit what they sought to teach us. we will find, my guest and I both think, that the experience speaks to who we are now, not, like Socrates did, who we ought to be if we were different and better. Existentialists are talking to us. It's about time we took another listen. And now our guest, Gordon Marino, is a professor of philosophy and curator of the Hong Kierkegaard Library at St. Olaf's College in Minnesota. He is author and editor of several books, including The Existential Survival Guide, How to Live Authentically in an Inauthentic Age, which was just released a couple of weeks ago. Gordon, welcome to Why.
Oh, thanks, Jack. I love your monologue. That was fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Really great.
I appreciate that. Hopefully, it will set the themes for our discussion and it will inspire people to respond to our audience. We are pre-recording, so we won't be taking any questions. But if you'd like to send your comments, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post a comment on facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or visit our live chat room at whyradioshow.org. So first of all, before the formal stuff starts, Gordon, the book just came out a couple weeks ago. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Are we your first interview since it came out?
Yes.
Oh,
it came out the 24th of April, yeah.
I will do my best not to sour the experience. It's wonderful to hold. It's wonderful to look at. It's a great book to read, very accessible. I'm super excited for it. I hope you are as well.
Yeah, I am. It's quite a trek.
I'm sure. And I want to talk about that because the book has so many memoir elements intertwined with the existentialism, and there's some difficulties that you embrace and are very honest about. And that leads me to actually my first question. My instinct when I got the book was that the existentialists were sort of a funny place to look for guidance. They were not a happy or a well-adjusted bunch. Kierkegaard was a depressive. Camus was a philanderer. Heidegger may have been a Nazi. They seem ill-disposed to be role models. So what inspired you to look at them for solutions to our modern dilemma?
Well, the first person I looked at was Kierkegaard because I feel like the existentialists, and in particular Kierkegaard, were really good at addressing what we're up against in ourselves. And I was up against a pretty powerful depression after a breakup of a marriage when I was a young man. I think that they're not so much fixated on happiness as on something else, on authenticity, on becoming – and in Kierkegaard's case, becoming a faithful human being. So I didn't look to them as role models for how to be happy or self-fulfilled.
This runs counter to the spirit of the age, doesn't it? This notion that happiness isn't the most important thing. Is it
– Very much so, Jack, yeah.
Is that – Do you find it difficult to make that argument that, look, we're focused on the – I mean even Aristotle, right, 2,000 years ago, sees happiness as the final goal even though his definition of happiness is a bit different than ours. Is it hard to address a modern audience starting with the presumption that focusing on happiness is the wrong target?
Yes, yeah, and for example, for Kierkegaard, the aim in life was to become an earnest, serious individual. And my students, when I talk to them about that, they have a hard time even connecting with the term, you know, what it means to be earnest or serious. And he thought that was much more important than happiness. So, yeah, it's a hard sell sometimes. There's not even the vocabulary there sometimes to talk about it. So sometimes I'll say discuss the issue of character they resonate with a little bit more. But they tend to make a God term out of happiness. There's no doubt about that. We do. And self-fulfillment and all these checklists about what to do when you're upset or how to be happier, those kinds of things. We all want this kind of obsession with a method, expertise. Yeah, so it does run counter to our culture.
I would think that a university classroom would be amongst the hardest places to put this out because, right, we all know it's important to be earnest, right? But the students, they aren't earnest anymore. They're achievement seekers. They're job seekers. It may be a little different because you're teaching at a smaller liberal arts school, but certainly at the University of North Dakota, it's very hard to find students who are committed to the ethos of being a student and who have that earnest expression of learning. They are going through the motions in order to do what they think is next. So
yeah, there's a real terror, don't you think? I think there's a real terror of not being successful.
There is.
Know, and it just overrides everything, you know, oftentimes. And there's some sense that it's to be unsuccessful in America is to be invisible, to be a loser, so to speak, right? So, yeah, there's a real terror of that.
Does changing the focus from happiness necessitate changing the focus from success? I mean, you actually don't mention success in that sense in the book that I recall, but that's a really powerful comment, that this notion that the students are afraid that they're not going to succeed, and then of course their parents are afraid that they're not going to succeed, and you're a parent and I'm a parent, we know that
right.
Parents are also afraid of not succeeding as being parents. So this pressure to succeed does that too have to be pushed aside?
Yeah, well, I try to get students to think a little bit about what kind of – instead of what they want to do or how they want to be successful, about what kind of people they want to be. And, for example, I have many advisees and they never come in to me and ask, you know, never come in and talk about that issue. And so I try to push students to talk about what kind of human being do you want to be and to judge your success according to that, because there's so many – whether or not you're successful in life, there's so many contingencies, and it's not as important as what kind of person you want to be.
And the existentialists struggle with this. Sartre calls it facticity, right? This notion that we have all of these choices, yet we're also bound by the reality that we face. And if we're African-American, we have to deal with the social conditions mm-hmm. of being African-American. If we're men or women or American or Iraqi or what have you, how much do the students and how much does your audience in general – how comfortable are they with the notion that we have this freedom of choice that the existentialists put forth when so much of our political discourse is about the limiting options of race and gender and things like that?
Mm-hmm. And also the kind of reductionism in the field of psychology, clinical psychology. Yeah. So I'm not sure how comfortable they are with it, but I do know that there's a lot of them that are seeking another vocabulary to think about their internal life in, and in that sense, these Galileos of the inner world are very attractive to them. Another way of, you know, these great introspectors. So, they get the idea of the connection between freedom and anxiety, which is something that the existentialists bring up all the time. They certainly are acquainted with anxiety.
yes,
they
are.
Connected with choice. Yeah, yeah.
And I've said on the show before, and I want to get back to this in a minute, but I want to ask you about something that you just said. I've said on the show several times that I think our students are clinically depressed, that mm-hmm. our students are struggling with overwork and being forced to look at the future and never be present in the now. And I want to talk about that in a minute because, of course, the existentialists spend a lot of time talking about despair and anxiety and depression. But first, you use this phrase, the Galileos of the inner world and these kings of introspection.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that they were able to look around themselves and find things about human nature that were of essential importance. And today, I don't see many great introspectors around. I mean, even the 70s, for example, you had the denial of death, Becker and a bunch of other people like that, and Eric Erickson. And so this is a paucity of a language to think about your inner life in terms of. And I do think students do crave that. At least that's what I find. I do. They're fascinated by Kierkegaard's descriptions of despair and sickness unto death. But they're looking for another vocabulary to think about their lives in rather than adjusting their serotonin levels or whatever.
When you talk about there not being focus on introspection, the first people that popped in my mind were Oprah and Dr. Phil, right? These are visions of what introspection looks like. Here's a problem. Let's name it. Let's solve it. Let's go on to the commercial. Do you think that this is a fair model of how we think about self-reflection now? Do you think that I'm being overly cynical?
No, I think that's the general model, is they're looking for some method, and wherever there's a problem, we want to bring in an expert. For example, there's been a lot of discussion about how to have conversations between people who disagree with each other. So the college will bring in experts on civil discourse. So they look to an expert class for everything and a method a lot of the time, a checklist. And I think that's quite different in the spirit of, say, Kierkegaard.
I want to push you on this, and then I want to ask how Kierkegaard addresses, but isn't one of the criticisms now that we're actually rejecting the notion of expertise, right? Donald Trump, the great criticism is that he doesn't know what he's doing. His minions, from Rudy Giuliani to others, seem less than skilled. And there is this sense in the country that every opinion is equal, that there's no such thing as knowledge. It's just a matter of what you think. And so I wonder if you could explain what you mean by relying on expertise, because I think you're talking about something different, but at the same time, there is this sense in my mind that one of the great criticisms is that the notion of expertise is disappearing.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying about the Trump and company, but I still think, at least within in the circles I live in, that wherever there's a problem, there's a turn to an expert, have a workshop, you know, do a seminar, as though yeah. So I think that's still pretty prevalent. Ethics experts, all kinds of, you know, everything. So I think the expert class, I call them lifestyle engineers, I still think they hold a lot of sway.
So the sort of culture of consultants, right? We have this problem.
Yeah. Diversity, inclusiveness, that kind of thing. Let's bring in an expert, have them talk to us how to teach that and how to talk to one another. Yeah. And I think that's also part of therapeutic culture that I talk about in the book quite a bit, right? Everything's a form of therapy, which comes from my mentor, Philip Reeve.
Right. So we have that instance in Starbucks a couple of weeks ago where there was the African-American men who were arrested for just waiting for friends. And right. Starbucks' solution was to close the shops for half a day and do a industry-wide workshop, right, that's supposed to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what does someone like Kierkegaard have to say about that? Is that going down the wrong path? Is it too artificial? What does Kierkegaard say about this notion of bringing someone in to solve the problem, to tell us how to think?
Well, I think on all the essential matters, Kierkegaard believed that we basically know what the right thing to do is, or have that knowledge within us, that there's a certain kind of knowledge about life that's universally distributed, and that we tend towards self-deception, that self-deception is the problem. It's not that we need more knowledge to be, say, upstanding, ethical people. We need to come into a new relationship to what we know, need to act on it, to have a more passionate relationship to our ethical ideals. So I think he would take issue with this idea of, well, if you have a problem, you need a workshop or an ethics expert or whatever.
Talk a little bit more about what it means to sort of know already what the right thing to do is.
Well, take something like social justice. I mean, so his feeling was that people know what the right thing to do is, but they don't have a passionate relationship with it. They don't act on it, right? They speculate. So he stressed a lot that we need to think more about how we appropriate our ideals, what our relationship to our ideals are. So, for example, it's easy to talk about love and everything, but are you a loving individual? Do you go out of your way to help people? So he's more about the not about the knowledge, but about the belief, our relationship to our ideals themselves. So instead of hitting, say, like on Facebook, going out and doing something, you know. So I think that's definitely where he emphasized a lot. And to some extent, that's from his pietistic background. Had something to do with that, I think. But I think there's a lot to be said there. So do you really mean – he's claiming that you don't know what you're saying. You don't understand your talk unless you walk the talk.
Where do these ideals come from? How do we choose the ideal that we're supposed to pursue?
Yeah, his assumption is that they're there, that they're universally distributed. In the same sense, I think that Kant thought that our knowledge of right and wrong was universally distributed. So he more or less assumes that it's there.
What does that mean, universally distributed?
That people know the difference between right and wrong if they think about it, and oftentimes don't have to think about it. But that doing the right thing will often lead us into, on his account, will lead us into collisions with our long and short-term interests. For example, if you're a policeman and you see your partner doing something abusive, you turn that person in. It's you're in trouble. It's all, you know, you're really in trouble, you know. And I like to stress that his claim is that to lead a righteous life, you're gonna have to make sacrifices. There's gonna be collisions, and I try to tell my students to think about those, because a lot of time, and I'm sure you know this too, Jack, that they just jump out of nowhere at you. All of a sudden, you're in a situation, and you've got to make a choice.
Right.
You know, and I think it's good to rehearse what you want to do. You know, to think about that a little bit. Right, take somebody like the fellow who turned in the people in the My Lai massacre. Right. That man had to train his guns on U.S. troops and say, you do anything more and I'll shoot you, right? And that came out of nowhere. He was coming in a helicopter, right? Just saw what was going on. So Kierkegaard is very emphatic about the fact, the idea that about the collision between morality and so-called happiness or our best interests. And I find that really to be quite true.
You used an example in passing, and you spent a bit more time on in the book in this situation of a police officer who sees his partner doing something inappropriate and wants to turn him in, but knows that if he turns him in, he'll get in trouble, he'll be a pariah, and he has this opportunity, right? His sergeant or his commander, whomever, is walking by and says, "Do you have anything to tell me?" And there's this moment of decision. Why is that moment of decision so important? What happens psychologically when a person is trying to decide what the right thing to do is?
Well, for example, in that case, I think I mentioned that. Just assume the guy has the person has a family. This officer has a family, and then the next thing they're thinking is, well, you know, I have a job. I need to feed my family. And before you know it, the person says, well, you know, maybe I'll think about this a little bit, and then the next thing you know, it wasn't so bad. It was just an aberration. So at that moment, there's this collision between our desire for self-fulfillment, happiness, security, and doing the right thing.
But you also point out that the longer you wait, the harder it is to do the right thing, right?
That's often the case, right? I'll sleep on it. And I talk about situations in which I did the wrong thing, right? And when we sleep on it, we usually sleep away from the moral issue, the doing the right path.
Is that because for the existentialists, there's a tension between thought and action, that thinking is not a form of doing?
That's right. I think so, yeah. Yeah, that there's a difference. Well, that's one of the things that earmarks him, is this less than complete confidence in our rationality and our thought process and abstractions, right? One of the things about the existentialists, especially Kierkegaard, is this idea of thinking about life from the inside out. For example, he will talk about, look, we all know all these objective facts about death, that if you take arsenic, you're going to die. The protagonist dies in the fifth act, blah, 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 all these objective facts. But that doesn't tell you what it means that you're going to die. Right? So this difference between kind of an abstract knowledge and what something means to you. So I think that's an important part of it. This inside-out perspective is an important aspect of the existential thought.
What does meaning mean in that sense? When you say we don't know what death means to us, what does that term mean?
Well, that it means to have something different. I take Ivan, the Death of Ivan Illich, one of my favorite books, right? So he says, he has this syllogism, all men are mortal, Caius is a man, therefore Caius is mortal. And that's an abstract understanding and quite different than what it means to understand that you're going to die. And I would think that the kind of sense of meaning and understanding that Kierkegaard and Tolstoy are pointing to is one that includes an affect, an emotion, you know. So I think it's a kind of feeling, it's an understanding that includes an emotion and a feeling. Right? So, that's how I see it.
Can we tell the difference between a fleeting emotion and an emotion that is representative of meaning that has a profound impact on us?
Yeah. For example, so in this one of his great discourses, which is really accessible and people might like to read, is At a Graveside. And it's in a book called Three Discourses on Imagined Situations. And there he talks about, you know, the lessons we can learn from understanding that we're going to die, our own, what it means for us to die. And there he says that when we understand that, it heightens the when you realize that time is finite, that it increases the value. Finite things take on an infinite value, become more important. So you'd be less reckless with your relationships. You'd say, you know, if you have an argument, you'd settle it, right? So it would be combined with action. So to understand that you're going to understand your own mortality would be to lead a certain kind of life. And I think you find that in Tolstoy's Ivan Illich too, right? That you'd be closer to people, that you wouldn't waste time, you wouldn't be reckless.
When we come back, I want to talk more about this personal relationships. I want to bring up some of the memoir aspects of your book, and I want to focus on freedom and authenticity and see what the existentialists in particular bring to the table. But before that, we'll take a break. You're listening to Gordon Marino and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Gordon Marino about the existentialists and about living an authentic life in an inauthentic age. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about freedom and what that means. And what popped into my head is a story from a long time ago that I hope I haven't told on the show before, but it's been close to 10 years. I was involved in a lawsuit for the right to vote when I was a college student. I fell through the cracks. The details aren't important. And I ended up winning and being the sole person on the campus who got to vote. I ran a campaign on campus to vote for the person that students chose as a sort of symbolic gesture of enfranchisement. They voted for a person. And I went into the voting booth. And in New York State, where I was going to school, it was the old-fashioned booth where you pull the lever and the curtain closes. And I'm about to vote. And I stop and I realize I could vote for anybody. I could vote for, at the time it was Dukakis or Jackson or Bush or whomever. I could vote for anyone. No one would ever know, and I could walk out and lie. And I made this commitment to vote for the person that the students voted for, but I could do whatever I wanted. And this was an incredibly powerful experience for me. It was an experience that has stayed with me for years and years about what it means to be free, because being free meant no one holding me accountable for what I did. Except, of course, I held myself accountable. I knew what I was doing. I knew that I'd have to live with not doing it and lying if I didn't do it and lied. Now, I can tell you I voted for who I said I would vote for, and you can believe me or not. But what's important is that moment of absolute freedom where I am the only person who is looking at myself. So, Gordon, I want to ask, is this experience, this moment of freedom, am I right in interpreting this as an existentialist moment, as an example of precisely what the existentialists call human freedom?
Yeah, that moment of choice. Yeah, it sounds right to me. That's quite a story. Yeah, and I think that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about with the example of the policeman, right? Yeah, so that seems right to me. And also, Sartre, for example, will insist that in those situations we don't have any objective, you know, guidelines for how to choose, and so that freedom of choice comes with anxiety. And also, despair, he says, about because we don't know whether or not it's going to lead to. There's no guarantee that your choices will lead to the right the consequences you're hoping, right? So.
You make the point in the book that we spend a lot of time talking about depression, but we don't really talk about this notion of despair. What does despair mean, and why is it a word that we should reintroduce into the vocabulary?
Yeah, so Kierkegaard draws this distinction, I think, between despair and depression. And he seemed to think you could be or between psychological and spiritual health. We tell a lot of people in the United States talk about they're spiritual but not religious. Well, then we still want to ask, what does it mean to be spiritually healthy as opposed to psychologically healthy? And I think Kierkegaard saw himself as a person who was quite depressive and at the same time in good spiritual fettle, good in good spirits. And so he says that despair is not most people think of despair as a particular feeling. He says it's not a feeling. It's a desire to be rid of yourself, not to become yourself and everything. And so I think for him, despair would be – you take the distinction between despair and depression. A person who was depressed and identified themselves with that and gave up their moral projects, gave up their visions of life, that person would fall into – be falling into despair. So I think in terms of our relationship, we have a set of emotions, and then – but on top of that, we have a way of relating to our emotions. And if we relate to them in the wrong way, we fall into despair.
That's really interesting. What's the difference between having emotions and relating to emotions?
Okay, so suppose I feel real – if I'm having – suppose I'm going through a rough time feeling terrible and everything and just feel completely identified with that feeling, and give up my aspirations to say – suppose one of my aspirations before that was to be a loving, kind human being and – because of the depression, I just feel like it's impossible. I can't do it. I think while we don't have control over our emotions, we do have a lot of sway over how we relate to our emotions, what we do with our emotions. Do you push through it and try to be a loving person, even though you feel like nothing matters at certain times? And it's when we give up that relationship to our emotions that I think from – at least in my sweetened version of Kierkegaard is where is where we fall into despair. Now for him, it's losing faith in God and in the belief that you have a self, that you're born to be a certain kind of self, right? So I try to provide so he always thinks in terms of faith. It's always faith for him, right? To despair is to give up on the eternal in yourself. But I think there's also another way of understanding that.
What's the difference between what you're saying now and how you deal with the emotions and how you act on the emotions and those who say when we talk about addiction, when we talk about dysfunction or self-destruction, that really it's just a problem of willpower and people just have to be strong and put up with it. You actually tell the story of a teacher when you were in school who responded to your assertion of being depressed as saying, basically just get over it, be a man sort of thing. What's the difference between the existentialist claim of relating to your emotions in a way that inspires action and the more sort of
– Right. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Be tough enough.
Right.
Which I think is appropriate – which is sometimes appropriate as I'm sure you felt in – classroom situations at exam times too, right? But I think the difference is in tone. It's not that you yell at yourself. It's that you're this realization. I have a higher task in life of becoming a certain kind of human being, and I'm not going to let these feelings stop me from doing that. So I have a vision of what kind of person you want to be. And for Kierkegaard often emphasizes that when you have courage, it's one fear drives out another. So suppose you were anxious and tempted to lie to a professor or something about, I can't make it to my exam because of, grandma died again or whatever.
But, the 15th right, grandma.
Right. And you, if you were more afraid of being a jerk than a failing, then you'd still go to the exam, right? So for him, a lot of the time, it really is a matter of knowing what to fear. And the real thing to fear is being a jerk, not being a good, loving person.
And this connects to Sartre's idea, right, that we realize who we are by what we choose. Echoes of Aristotle here that if we accept the lie and don't go to the class, then we value being a jerk, right? We are okay with being a jerk.
Yeah, either that or we tell ourselves we'll tell the truth the next time. We don't think that by lying we become a liar, right? I mean, that's one of Aristotle's points, right? When I think when you go down the wrong path, you start a certain habit. You go in, you tell your first lie, and you can become a liar, become a habit, right? But we tell ourselves, maybe next time I'll be. It doesn't matter, If suppose you're a pre-med student and you're taking a class in aesthetics or something, you might say to yourself, "Well, this isn't going to enter into what I'm doing later on in life, so it doesn't. It's okay to cheat."
I want to talk about your life a little bit because intertwined within the philosophical discussion is a memoir, and there's a discussion about addiction and self-destructive behavior. I want to go in backwards, though.
Mm-hmm.
you spend some time talking about boxing. You're a boxing coach right now.
Yeah.
You boxed for a while when you were younger. What do you say to someone who says, well, you keep talking about loving kindness, but boxing isn't loving and kind. Boxing is brutal and violent. Where does something like that fit in? And the reason why I ask this is because I think that part of what's happening on the existentialist is that they're asking us to look beneath the surface of what things look like to us, but rather talk about the meaning behind it. And so what's the meaning behind boxing, and how does it fit into this higher goal of being a good person? When
being a loving person, right?
Right.
What am I talking about? That sounds crazy, right? Yeah, okay. I think that boxing, we don't get a lot of workshops in with certain emotions that are so important in life, like anxiety and rage. And people who are consistently work at boxing get a lot of practice with those emotions and get control over the emotions and makes them less violent people, for one thing. You know, not all of them, but it ultimately makes them they get control of their emotional and also develop a level of self-knowledge there, because boxing's a real gut check. You find out a lot about yourself when you're in the ring. But also I found that a lot of the kids that I work with over the past 30 years, they come from environments where they don't get much love, don't get any affirmation. And they're angry and they go to school and they get in trouble in school and all they get is yelled at all the time. And they finally get in this community of people where they said, man, you're good at something. You know, they get the sunshine of some kind of affirmation and they blossom. A lot of time and they're really at home in themselves. People who are boxers are very at home in themselves a lot of time and therefore more capable of being vulnerable. And again, this doesn't hold for all boxers. A lot of I do a lot of boxing journalism, so I know a lot of people in professional boxing who might not fit in there. But by and large, that love and affirmation and that feeling at home in themselves, a new sense of self-respect, very potent, makes them better people.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I think about some of the great boxing movies, right? The early Rockies and actually the later
just
Rockies.
Just the first
not the middle ones.
Come on. The other ones are ridiculous.
Creed is wonderful, and I'm a big fan of Rocky Balboa, but that's another conversation.
We could spar about that.
Those movies, the good ones, are about love and about Rocky and his love, finding love from Adrian, finding love from Mickey, the coach, and compare that to Raging Bull, which is not about love, right? Which is about self-destructiveness and fame and things like that. And so I guess there's more of a legacy of love and care and self-training. And in a piece that I wrote years ago, actually one of my first public philosophy pieces, I wrote that sports movies are the only movies that show us the true development of knowledge. That you start with an athlete who doesn't know what they're doing, and then over time trains and gets better and trains and trains and trains and gets better. But when we have movies about school or movies like Good Will Hunting, knowledge is magical, right? It just sort of happens. Someone has it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what is it about boxing that is so existential? Why is you said you learn a lot about yourself in the ring. What do you learn about yourself in the ring, and why is it that such a physical activity can give us such an insight into our psyche, our persona, our self? What is it about that sport that does that?
Well, you learn what you're willing to do to win. You find out that if you get too enraged, you're not going to be able to perform. You learn about anxiety. Like one of the big lessons I try to teach with my boxing students is to be at home with anxiety. That fear is a big part of it. I've had boxers before fights and they're not anxious. I know we're in big trouble. You know, so this ability to sit with anxiety and not panic about it, which I think is a real life lesson. It's also how to take a blow, how to take a punch. To do the right thing in life, you're going to take punches, and you get some practice at that in the ring. You know, for example, when really terrible things happen with students, sometimes I'll tell them it's like a punch. I mean, you feel it and it wears off, but you got to take some deep breaths and let it run through you. So tremendous lessons like that, but also emphasis on courage, on dealing with fear, which we don't stress enough in our society. that we have to learn. That, I mean, that boxing is practice in dealing with fear. That's why I talk about that one exercise I do, of course, the tendency in boxing is when someone's trying to punch you to back up just to keep backing up, which is the most dangerous thing to do. And so I'll stand behind somebody and I'll call it the courage exercise, and the other person's throwing punches and you can't back up, you know. And so I think there's not a lot of avenues or places today where we get, you know, practice and developing courage. They don't even talk about when I was a football coach at Yale and here and other places. And it used to be there was a lot of talk, when I was growing up, there was a lot of talk about it being, you know, courage and this kind of stuff. Not much today. So if we're going to be good people, we need courage. And if we're going to develop courage, we need to be able to deal with fear. We need to get some practice at it. End of sermon. I'm sounding like a corner man now.
No, but this is existentialism in action, right? You have spent your life in and around the boxing ring. And you have spent your life being a philosopher, professional eventually, amateur before. And that's how you look at the world. And isn't that part of what existentialism is going to tell us, right? That the things that are the most meaningful to us in terms of what we do are also going to be the things that are the most meaningful in terms of explaining ourselves?
I'll say that. Could you clarify that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, look – we, as a boxer, as a boxing coach, as a boxing journalist, that's got to have a profound effect on who you are, on how you see yourself,
right,
and on how you
right.
see the world.
True.
So how else are you going to explain the values that you hold dear if not through boxing, right? And so I guess the point that I'm making, or the question that I'm asking, I'm not sure which it is, isn't the existentialist argument that since we define meaning for ourselves, and since our choices and our experiences are the direct connection to our meaning, that it's the very point that you are so excited and revert to being a corner man that is the proof that existentialism has something powerful? Because to steal a line from John Stuart Mill, the proof is that people do it, right? The proof of existentialism is that when we get to something we care about, that's when we get to explain our meanings. That's when we get to explain our values. Isn't that what existentialism is ultimately saying?
Well, I don't know, because the existentialists are such a motley crew. Like, there's so many differences between Sartre and Kierkegaard. And I don't think, for example, Kierkegaard would have a lot to say about explaining our value. I don't think he'd see that as really important, that it was really need to explain what your value. So I think there's quite a few there's themes that link them together, but I'm not so sure that I could lump them all together as having one particular position on, say, the issue of meaning. Or the value of life, or your ability to, and the whole idea of an argument. They don't think, like Kierkegaard doesn't think in terms of, you know, what's your argument, which is I think the existentialists actually raise this important question of, you know, what constitutes an argument. For example, Kierkegaard's arguments are oftentimes pictures of people, and the question is whether or not they're see yourself in them. You know, they're not the kind of arguments that we find in philosophy colloquium all the time. So I think they raise the question of what counts as a reason or an argument.
Is that why literature, traditionally defined, plays such an important role in existentialism? We have Camus, who's a novelist. Sartre writes novels and plays in particular. Kierkegaard has these portraits of people. Is the appeal of the literature showing, not telling?
That's a good distinction, Jack. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, you took a look at The Death of Ivan Illich, which, again, I just taught Tolstoy. I mean, I think it's such a lapidary, beautiful text, and talks about how alienated people are from one another. But it doesn't just lay it out there. He paints this picture, which you can see it, you know. And I think that's quite different than giving some presenting some abstract argument has a different power to it.
Does that help us or hinder us from finding commonality amidst diversity? And what I mean by this is one of the classical arguments for argument is that logic is universal, that all human beings have the same basic reasoning process, although that eventually comes under attack. That's certainly the classical idea. But we live in a world in which there's tremendous diversity, in which there's different religions and different races and different classes and radically different experiences. And does the literary nature of existentialism help us bridge that gap? And subordinate to that is this question. I cited two Europeans in the monologue, and we've been talking about Europeans, or although I think Camus was North African, right?
Right.
I'm going to put this in the crudest way possible, and then we can find a more sophisticated. You know, is existentialism for Black people too? Right. I mean, where does the literature solve the problem of diversity, or does the literature exacerbate the difference?
So what do you mean by the problem of diversity? Talk about that a little more.
If I have the experience that I have, right, I grew up in New York City in a very poor neighborhood, in a very bad neighborhood.
I think I could hear a little New Yorker in you.
there's just get me angry. You throw punches and I throw curses. It's the New Yorker.
I throw curses too, baby.
But I had a very difficult time adjusting to North Dakota. I'm on my 17th year and I'm
that's
still
a big
adjusting.
Surprise.
And because it was a very diverse experience, yet at the same time, I will use the language of the left here, being read as a Caucasian, I have this white privilege that allows me to enter the community in a certain way that an African-American who grew up in my neighborhood would have a much harder time, right?
Right.
We live in a community in which race, gender, religion, especially Islam right now is part of the discourse. So the question I have is, when we have literary experiences like Kafka's The Trial.
Oh, take Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, the prologue. I mean, there's a person who is steeped in Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard comes up all over it. Beautiful example of the problem of race, right? The prologue to Invisible Man, that to be marginalized in society is to be invisible, to be treated like an object. I think there's a lot to be said there in favor of literature.
And you talk about Invisible Man in the book. Mm. I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question. To what extent is existentialism – okay. Is existentialism so I keep refining the question.
Where are you going, baby?
No, I like doing this because it's very important. I think we all see on television so often – pundits who have perfect questions and perfect answers never think. And I love on the show when the guest or I have to rearticulate things because that's what the listeners are going through. They're like, wait a minute, well, let me
think. Okay, keep rearticulating it. Come on, baby. Let's go.
And so the question is, where is the intersection existentialism between the individual and the cultural experience? Can an individual African American define for him or herself what the Black experience means, or is the Black experience a sort of a brute fact about the world that has to be accepted in order to figure out who someone is? The same question for a white person, for an Asian person, for a Native American, for whatever category we want to put. Where's the intersection between what it means to be an individual and the hard and fastness of the cultural constructs and rules and expectations that we are a part of?
Yeah, I don't know that anybody could come up with a map or a logarithm for that. But one of the intersections that I thought of in the book and just mentioned briefly was that Kierkegaard stresses how important it is to love that in order to love other people, you have to love yourself in the proper sense of the word, right? You have to care about your soul, your character. And when people are marginalized and treated like dirt, it gets really hard to love yourself. It's a real impediment. And that's one of the places where I think where racism and sexism are really poisonous, you know, and that Kierkegaard, I think, helps us understand that, right? So the ability to love yourself depends upon this love from other people, right? And if you're treated like dirt, it makes it hard to love yourself, you know? And seeing the Ellison text, that he talks about, not only makes it hard to love yourself. It leads to this weariness and confusion. So I think there are places in, for all the emphasis on the individual, that there are places in these existential texts that address that, you know. So if we go take a Kierkegaardian perspective on some of the things we talk about today, for example, a lot of talk at our college about privilege and all that stuff. But what does it mean to really – and is it a matter of like – and then sometimes I see people lacerate themselves about it. But I don't see anybody giving up any privilege. I don't see anybody giving up any privilege. So what would it mean to really feel – understand your privilege and do something about it? So Kierkegaard and then Sartre too. This idea that sometimes we talk a lot about things that we don't really act upon, don't really change our lives at all. You know, so I'm raising a question about this, some of the patois about privilege and everything today.
So let me go back to the memoir aspect, because I think this is a discussion that I want to have about change and how we see mm-hmm. ourselves and how we change.
Right.
Talk a little bit about – I certainly don't want to describe for the audience, in my words, your experience as you articulate. Talk a little bit about your childhood and the dysfunctions that you describe in the book and how it made you ready for existentialism.
Well, that's a pretty broad. That's a little.
Sure, I know.
That's a tough one, Jack. But I grew up in a house in which it was a good deal, a lot of love, but a tremendous amount of fights between my parents all the time. A lot of violence, scary, you know. So it made me think a lot about who's right, who's wrong, that kind of thing. And it certainly gave me an edge of anger and fear. You know, made me an insomniac. I think, you know, because a lot of times the fights would start at night. So it created a deep need for some solace and understanding of, you know, what's going on in life. You know, it was crazy, in part because of this kind of dichotomy between things being, you know, on the one hand having these loving parents, but on the other hand, them going at each other with, you know, hammer and tong at night, and then kind of in the morning pretending like, oh, everything's okay, you know. So
and you found solace in the bottle, right? Or sought solace in the bottle.
Yeah, yeah. Other things as well. Yeah, yeah. And then when I went through this, I was married to someone who had went through a breakup early on in life, and that was just devastating for me. And so yeah, a lot of losses and feeling like I was disintegrating and was. I mean, yeah. So so Kierkegaard helped me make sense of. So one of the ways that Kierkegaard helped me was that he helped me feel that. Suffering wasn't a stench, that you could do it well or poorly, that it was an action, that you could do it nobly. And this was after the breakup with my first wife and when I was in the mental hospital at one point and everything. And so that was very edifying for me, upbuilding.
I wonder if you could explain that, what that means, that suffering was not a stench, that you could do poorly or well. What do you mean by that?
Well, that sometimes you feel like a leper when you're severely depressed, anxious, right? It feels like nobody wants – you just feel like worthless, and that I had a very passive attitude towards it. Like, you know, life was over and I'm no good and blah, 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 and that just bide my time. And he helped me and people – some people around me that I saw reach through pain and be loving people helped me as well. But somehow I got the message from him that, look, listen, this psychological suffering is part of life, and you can either let it crush you or you can try to develop from it. And so it really helped me wake up a little bit.
And I'm very interested in that process, because the introduction to the book has a more detailed account of your life. And then interspersed within the chapters are more stories and connections. There isn't as clear an account of the period in which you're healing and the way in which the existentialists, Kierkegaard specifically, helped you heal. Do you think that or maybe heal's not the wrong word, function, move to the next chapter. What is it about the existentialists? Could you talk a little bit about this period in your life, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure.
And how the texts and the readings helped you move from this more self-destructive period in your life to the classy, well-regarded professional that you are today?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was also – I wrote a was in therapy at the time with a bodhisattva of a therapist is I still talk to after 45 years. I wrote a piece in the long in the New York Times. I think it's called The Long Conversation about that. Her name is Beatrice Beebe, and so I was in therapy, and she treated me for free because I didn't have any money, and it was a. So the power of relationships is really, in addition to reading Kierkegaard, I think relationships are so important in healing. And I think in our modern understanding of mental health, that's kind of gone out the window with just the use of medications and very short-term therapy. So that was a very, very important. And in the process of therapy and Kierkegaard, reading Kierkegaard, who also, I got to say, helped me take a new approach to faith. Now help me try to trust in God, and I know that'll offend some people, but it did. I still try to trust in God, and in part he was able to do that because he made me see what a leap of the idea of the leap of faith. It seemed to me that trusting in God seems relatively more or less irrational. He always talks about faith as this collision with reason, so that was very important and. Helping me learn to sit with my emotions and not freak out and go get drunk or take some drugs, you know. So part of the lesson was learning to sit with emotions, you know, and not run. You know?
Was it important to you that Kierkegaard himself was a lifelong struggle with depression? Did you see yourself in him?
It was clear to me that he knew what that was like, but that wasn't an important factor because I wasn't reading his journals that much then, his letters. It was just clear that he knew about it. And also he wrote The Concept of Anxiety. It was the depression and anxiety go together a lot. And that's what I found so appealing about it. These guys, Kierkegaard, again, in particular, helps us to face what we're up against in ourselves. Those ugly feelings. The piece I wrote on Envy in the New York Times the other day was about that. To be a good person is to struggle with certain emotions that we have. It's easy to be – it's easy to be really nice when, like, you just get a letter, you're accepted to med school, whatever. All the lights are green. It's easy to be a nice person then. Well, how about when things aren't so good, you know? And I think he addresses those internal obstacles a lot, and much better than the other existentialists, except maybe Tolstoy.
Do you think that existentialism can be either a substitute or a supplement for medication?
Oh yeah, I think it certainly can be a supplement. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
How so?
Well, in the way that it talks about how to really a new way of thinking about your emotional life. Again, this idea that it's one thing to be depressed; it's another thing to identify yourself. It doesn't that we have a relationship to our emotions that we have some sway over, and that's something you get in Sartre too, right? That emotions are interpretations, and I think the piety today is that we have no control over them; just get rid of them. Also, the idea that they're good things, that they're – for example, in Kierkegaard, you get this notion that anxiety is a sign that you're a spirit, right? That it's not just a symptom, a malady, and that you can learn something from depression, learn vulnerability, learn openness to others, right? So this idea that there's positive – there's also something to learn from these very difficult emotions. Yeah, so sure, definitely a supplement. Take it three times a day.
I think this is the most important and radical notion in the modern context that keeps coming up, which is that we don't just feel emotions. We're not just a slave to our emotions, that we have a relationship with our emotions. I keep thinking back to a conversation I had with my father. It was 1994. I was about to leave the country, go to Vienna. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I ever left the country. I was gone for 6 months. I ended up staying for a year and a half. I knew two words of German, please and whipped cream, both from John Irving novels. And it was the night before, and I was talking to my dad about how scared I was. And he said, well, you shouldn't be scared. You don't need to be scared. And my response was, it's okay to be scared. It's only not okay to do it – to not do it because I'm scared.
That's right.
And I think that's what you're doing, to criticize my dad, who was incredible influence in my life. Yeah. But this notion that we have this relationship with our emotions. You have that phrase. I'm not going to do it justice. You probably know it by heart now. That the self is a relation.
Yeah, I do. I definitely know that one, Jack.
Could you say it to the audience?
The self is a relation that relates itself to itself.
Yes, the self is a relation that relates itself to itself, right? And you explain it over and over again.
I got that tattooed on my right arm, so it puzzles a lot of boxing people.
It's a great quote. And of course, what it means is that we do have this relationship with ourselves, and right. we have this relationship with our emotions, and we can do things with it. And that's, I think, one of the insights.
Yeah, but the modern mentality, kind of medicalization of everything, discourages people from thinking that way. I think I tell the story in the book. I had a student who, of course, end of semester, can't write his papers. He says, I'm depressed. I need extra time. And I say, what's up? What's going on, man? And he says, I just need to titrate my chemicals, right? I need another form of medication. I said, but then he slips out with, my parents got divorced 2 weeks ago, but that shouldn't matter at all because I'm 20 and, you know, as though, so there's an invitation not to think about our experience, not to appreciate that relationship to our emotions. Right. And to appreciate the relationship to our emotions is in some sense to, be open to the task of reflection. And that's a painful process a lot of time. Right. I mean, so, there's a lot in our society that says that. Don't worry about thinking about it. It's just a waste of time. You know, just take this pill or just go to cognitive behavioral therapy and get a couple of tips about, you know, strategies, right?
And to the audience, what I want to say is that's the elevator pitch of your book, that the power of your book in the modern discussion is that it is a plea for reflection. It runs counter to the urge to – medicate immediately. You're very clear that you're not opposed to medication, and you give a very powerful story of someone for whom it's very useful. So I don't want anyone to think that you're wiping away that solution. It's very important. But
thanks for saying that, Jack. That's true. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. I am here to advocate for your ideas, right?
No, but that is something that people could get wrong. That I'm just saying, never take medication, anything like that.
No, and you're very clear that it plays a very important purpose, but you're also very clear that we need a space to give ourselves permission to reflect, that some of our reflection is painful, and the fact that it's painful doesn't mean that it's bad. The fact that it's difficult or complicated or leads to sadness, right? Of course you're going to be sad when your parents get divorced. In fact, the studies show that the older you are, the harder the divorce is on you. And so, right, if you want to get divorced when your kid's a year old, because when your kid's 20, it's a lot harder. And I say that as someone whose parents got divorced when he was a year and a half. The idea of the two of them together is so horrifying. I'm so grateful that they were divorced. They know I know this, so it's not a shock. But this idea that even though we reflect and it's painful, that doesn't mean we shouldn't reflect and it's not valuable. That working through the pain, working through the anxiety, working through the despair is part of the glory of the freedom of the human experience that can lead us to faith, that can lead us to love. It doesn't have to lead us to faith. It can lead us to self-awareness, self-understanding. You're very clear in the book that while there is this strain of existentialists and you yourself have this relationship with faith, that it need not be focused on God and faith, that there's room for everyone. So then let me ask you, following that, is there room for the Facebook generation? We are Well, that's what, yeah.
That's a sneak punch. Out of nowhere. After that one, you're going to say, was there room for the Facebook generation? Okay.
Well, what I mean by that, I'm leading you down a certain path, is our students and high school students, even younger, are constantly posing. They're projecting their life as the best life it can be. And this leads to anxiety from people who say, my life isn't that good. How do the existentialists fit to people whose experience of their self is one of branding and performance as opposed to one of intimacy and vulnerability?
They'd just be shaking their head, man. The existentialist pantheon, they'd all be shaking their head in sadness. It's terrible. Lack of intimacy. Man, you go to the gym today, like everybody's got earphones on. They're checking their – used to be you go to the gym and people would be – you know, you talk to one another. You'd get make friends there. Now, I literally was in the gym the other day and everybody had earphones on, was checking their Facebook – you know, was checking their phones. It's bad. It's bad. I think it's really bad for being – feelings of closeness, being together, you know. If you think of like intimacy and closeness as – most important things in life. I don't think Facebook, et cetera, is really much of a boon to that.
It's funny because one of the great gym experiences, and I don't know how many people would feel the same way, but one of the great gym experiences is someone coming up to you and asking them to spot you
when you're
on the bench.
That's right. That doesn't happen so much anymore. No,
it doesn't.
That's right. That's a good point, Jack. Yeah.
It's a sign of competence. It's a sign of acceptance. Even if you don't talk other than saying, you know, you can do it, lift it, you're almost there. There is an intimacy there.
That's right. And what's happened to our sense of intimacy? I think it's really detrimental to that. And that's one of the things I just realized, what a blessing it is to share your life with people, to share your life. That was, I don't know, I told the story in the book about a boxer I trained who – is it okay to tell a little story?
Sure, absolutely, please.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's this boxer I trained from Mexico, mostly boxers from Mexico, and he barely – he's a professional boxer, really good, and we're sitting in front of – he's training for a fight that was coming up on television and everything, and so we go to the – you know, I pick him up. We live in a small town, and it's hard to find – impossible to find sparring, so we had to drive all over the place to find good sparring for him. So we're up in Minneapolis, and the gym wasn't open when we got up there on a Saturday, and so we're sitting there, and, you know, he's a tough character, and my Spanish is baby Spanish. His English is baby English. But I had this little book next to me called The Big Porcupine. And I knew this my man there, Vicente Alfaro, that I knew he had three kids and was really a dedicated parent. And I also knew that how many words you hear in English is very important in being successful in school. So I got this the professor in me said, I hand him this book, read this book, you know. And he looks at me with his scary look, you know, like who. And he starts to read it, man. And this children's book, The Big Porcupine, and tears came to my eyes because I realized he's letting me into his life. And prior to that, I was like patting myself on the back a lot because, oh, I'm such a good guy because I spend my time training these kids, you know, and training people and service to others like that, you know. And I realized, man, here's this other human being from, you know, opening up his life and vulnerability to me and what a treasure that is. And that's helping me with students and in life and just this recognition of how important intimacy is and sharing our lives together, you know.
Do you think that there's any way to replicate that intimacy using social networks? Do you think that there's any way to make some social network an existential experience, or do you think that it's just so profoundly opposed to the relational aspect of it, to the intimate and authentic aspect of it, which I want to follow up in a second, that it's just – they're just different poles?
Well, I think they're different poles, but I also know that people that are sick or that are can't get out, can't – you know, locked up or, you know, are not – in situations where they're not mobile and can't be around others, that they can find a lot of it's very meaningful to them. So it's certainly good for some folks, but I think it's also, you know, addictive and detrimental to a sense of closeness and intimacy of sharing our lives together. But again, for some people, I know people that are sick, and that's how they connect, and it's really, really meaningful to them.
So a tool is a tool, and it's how human beings use it.
Yeah, yeah. Or if we go to Nietzsche, it's opposing values. It's not good or bad. There's good and bad. There's good and there's – it's something that's both good and bad, right? One of the things we learned from Nietzsche is this idea of the connection between opposing values, that it's not an either or, not a binary. I think that's true a lot of time.
And so I want to – we need to start wrapping up, but the title of the episode – and what I initially said we would talk about was this concept of authenticity. We actually really didn't use the word very much until just now. I wondered if you talk just a bit about what authenticity means and if you're able to sort of tie a little bit the conversation that we've had. How does love, how does intimacy, how does anxiety, how does depression, how does fear, how does morality – how do we get into the discussion of authenticity? What does authenticity mean, and why is it such a key concept that helps people get into the conversation.
Well, that was a...
I know. It's unfair.
You just hit me with an uppercut there, man. Come on. So anyhow, so the idea of authenticity, which most people don't talk about today, was a huge term in like the 70s and 60s. It's not a term that most people use today. And in the book, I talk about it as a, you know, some people think of it being your kind of a creative thing of being your true self. And whereas someone like Kierkegaard would say it's becoming who you really are. Right. So among the existentialists, there's quite a difference there. So someone like Nietzsche would say being authentic would be being, and he doesn't use the term, I don't think very much, if at all, would be stepping out from the herd and being creative and, you know, making your life an artwork. And whereas others, someone like Kierkegaard would be like, well, you could be really successful, but if you miss the boat on being a loving human being, you've missed the boat. You miss being authentic. You miss becoming your real self, right? So I think there's two ways of looking at that, and you can't sit around and say, well, you know, give me a good argument for what the self is, and then I'll go about it, right? So it's an either or, you know, either or, whether you think there's something deep down inside you, a self. I think of it a lot as someone being at home in their skin, being honest with themselves, right? I think of authenticity in that way a lot. Those are some of the characteristics I associate with it. Be able to deal with awkwardness, to be there for other people.
You know, I want to close just by making an observation. I'm looking at the table of contents of the book, and I'm looking at the order of the chapters, and I'm just going to read them aloud to you and to the audience, and I want to make a point. You start with anxiety, and then you go to through depression and despair, then death, then authenticity, then faith, then morality, then love. It seems to me, and I don't know whether this was intentional or not, that the progression of the chapters is a progression towards authenticity, that you start with the story of your life and you go through the most negative emotions and you end up through faith, morality, and ultimately to love, which is the most positive. And that whether you intend it or not, the book itself is an existentialist journey taking its readers to this place of authenticity. Whether they can choose to do it, whether they act on it, of course, is in their power, not yours. But I think it's a tremendously impressive task to take someone from the particulars of your own life to the universal experience of love that everyone ultimately aims for. And I just think it's worth saying to you and to the audience that in itself is tremendously powerful. And I found that progression of the book very, very moving. And while I myself as the host wasn't able to articulate that throughout this discussion, I think the book itself really brings people to the Kierkegaardian place of faith and love that you've been articulating. And so I just want to say that I think you've done that very, very well, and that the book can be a tremendous experience for people who are trying to find the way to self-reflect and find that love that allows them to relate to others as well as themselves.
I'm very grateful for that, and I think you have the trajectory of the book just right, and I'm really appreciate it, Jack.
Gordon, thank you so much for joining us on Why. This has been a tremendous discussion, and I think it opens up the avenue for a lot of future discussions and certainly for self-reflection for everybody who's listening. Thanks so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Gordon Marino and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Gordon Marino about authenticity and existentialism and trying to figure out how to live in a world full of fear and anxiety and despair. The existentialists believe that human beings are free. What they mean by this freedom is that we have the ability to choose our own meaning in life. Maybe that can be a life of faith. Maybe it can be a life of goodness. Maybe it can be even a life of hedonism and dastardliness. We are free to do those things. But what this means is that in the modern world, we are responsible for our own actions, and that makes us afraid. It makes us anxious. It makes us depressed. Sometimes the machine doesn't work well, and we need medicine to help us find equilibrium. But sometimes we're just not thinking enough. And what the existentialists want us to do, and what Gordon asks us to do, is to take the time to reflect not just on our actions, and not just on who we are, but on our relationship with our emotions. What are the consequences of being depressed? What are the consequences of being anxious? How do we fight through it? And how do we find meaning in the unpleasantness? It's trite to say that the journey is what matters. And it's trite to say that we learn from the punches, to use Gordon's boxing metaphor. But there is something powerful about the fact that even the sadness is valuable. Even the alienation has its power. If we lose our parents to divorce, it's okay to be sad. It's okay to have emotions. The question is, what is our relationship with that emotions? And how do we celebrate and manipulate and choose that relationship so that we make the best choices we can and be the person we want to be or the person we should be? What is the person we should be? What ideals do we strive for? These are great questions. What the existentialists did was put them on the table for us to ask them not as matters of philosophical abstract contemplation, but as matters of doing and living and acting. We act on our ideals. Are they the ideals that we want them to be? This is the question at hand. Gordon Marino is a boxing tutor. He's also a philosopher. He has lived a complex life of addiction and self-destruction, and he came out on the other side because he saw kinship in the ideas that people put forth. His book suggests, and I would suggest, that you can find some of that kinship too, whether your life is going well or your life is going poorly. The existentialists will help you survive, and they'll help you live authentically in an inauthentic age. And Gordon and I are glad to be a part of that with you. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.